One of the unique things of the age that we're in today is the gods that we worship, or are the gods that we worship. Because with evolution being the way it is, we don't have the normal pantheon of gods that the people have had in the past. We have a pantheon of gods, you know, cars, television sets, computers and all the rest of it, but they're very, very different. And largely we tend to worship ourselves, we tend to worship what man can do. A great deal more than people did in ancient times. Although there is prophesied to be a religious revival of some description when the beast and the false prophet working miracles will come to the fore, at this present time, this present Western world, it's certainly a very secular society, and the gods that we worship are very much secular based. But you know, when we look into the future, we will find that God will reduce all of the world unto a ruin. The world will take itself to the place of a ruin and take itself to the place where the entire earth will be destroyed. And even after that, you have seven last plagues as well that God will unleash on the world, on Christ on his return. And you've got the trumpet plagues prior to Christ's return, culminating in Christ's return, and then you have the seven last plagues. And there is a parallel, actually, between those two sets of plagues. But you know, when you go to ancient Egypt, there's also seven last plagues that you find in ancient Egypt. You can find that there are three to start off with, and then there's seven last ones. And the seven last ones were different from the three that started the whole series of plagues away. And just the difference is very similar to the trumpet plagues, which are, if you like, a type of the seven last plagues at the end time. In the time of the trumpet plagues, 144,000 are sealed just before the trumpet plagues start. In the same ways, when you come to the seven last plagues in the time of Egypt, you find that Israel was no longer affected for those seven last plagues, whereas the three before, they were. So there is actually a distinction between the two. And what I want to do today is I want to examine the plagues of Egypt because of this time of year that we're in, this time of year that we find ourselves in. I want to examine the plagues of Egypt. I also then want to go on and briefly examine the parallels between the trumpet plagues and the seven last plagues that we find in Revelation as well, because there are a parallel between the two. And these plagues, hopefully, if we live through into that time, that we will witness these things. And I also want to show how God will use them to humble man, because that really is the entire purpose of these plagues, both the trumpet plagues, the seven last plagues, and the full ten, when you look at Egypt as well. And the three areas I want to go into, first of all, I want to look at a little of the background of the plagues of Egypt. I want to just go into a little bit of the background that leads up into them. Secondly, I want to then show how each plague was actually against a specific deity or deities. There were specific deities there that they were actually aimed at, and he reduced all the deities of Egypt through them. And finally, I want to then go into the parallels between trumpet plagues and the seven last plagues. I don't know whether you've actually noticed that before, but I think that would be of interest to you, to see how there is, in fact, a parallel between the two as they go through. One being brought on before Christ's return, the other one being brought on after Christ's return, and how they fit together. So let's have a look at a bit of background then, first of all, over into the plagues of Egypt. Let's have a look in Exodus chapter 3. Exodus chapter 3, and we'll stay in this area around Exodus for much of the sermon. So if you've got a marker, certainly if you put it somewhere in Exodus, it might be good to be able to find your way back quickly. But Exodus chapter 3, in at verse 16, God says to Moses, go and gather the elders of Israel together, and say unto them, the eternal God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, appeared to me, saying, I have surely visited you, and have seen that which is done to you in Egypt. And I have said that I will bring you up out of the affliction of Egypt, into the land of the Canaanites, and the Hittites, and the Amorites, and the Perizzites, and Hivites, and Jebusites, to a land flowing with milk and honey. And they shall listen to your voice, and you will come, you and the elders of Israel, to the king of Egypt, and you will say to him, the eternal God of the Hebrews has met with us, and now let us go, we beseech you, 3 days' journey into the wilderness, that we may sacrifice the eternal our God. And I am sure that the king of Egypt will not let you go, no, not even by a mighty hand. And I will stretch out my hand and I will smite, or rather, probably, but by a strong hand would be better. In other words, he's not going to let you go until a real strong hand wipes out his will. And I will stretch out my hand and smite Egypt with all my wonders, which I will do in the midst thereof. And after that, he will let you go. So God knew, Christ knew, and it was Jesus Christ saying these things. He knew that this was going to take a certain period of time. And there were certain plagues that were going to have to be meted out on the actual Egyptians, and specifically on Pharaoh. In chapter 4, notice in verse 21, "And the Eternal said to Moses, when you go to return into Egypt, see that you do all the wonders before Pharaoh which I have put in your hands. But I will harden his heart, and he will not let the people go. And you will say to Pharaoh, thus says the Eternal, Israel is my son, even my firstborn." And this being a type, this is Exodus chapter 4, verse 22, this being a type when you're looking at the first fruits, because we are taken out of Egypt, but this is certainly a type of it. "And I say unto you, let my son go, that he may serve me. And if you refuse to let him go, behold, I'll slay your son, even your firstborn." So again, even the firstborn, Christ knew that that was going to actually take place. Even he knew the plagues and what in fact he was about to do. If you go into chapter 6, you find again the way in which God was going to be dealing with Egypt was going to be different from the way he dealt with, say, Abraham in the past. "When the Eternal said to Moses, now you will see what I will do to Pharaoh, for with a strong hand shall he let them go, and with a strong hand shall he drive them out of his land." That doesn't mean a strong hand of Pharaoh, it means a strong hand against Pharaoh, which will cause him to do that. "And God spoke to Moses and said to him, I am the Eternal, Yahweh, the Eternal One." It means the I was, I am, I will be. This is chapter 6, verse 2. And into verse 3 it says, "And I appeared to Abraham and Isaac and to Jacob by the name of El Shaddai." This means the great blesser, the one who blesses, that gives great abundance. "But by my name, Yahweh, I was not known to them." They never saw the kind of power that Moses and the Israelites were about to see. Now, they knew about his name being Yahweh, but they did not know about him in the sense that the power that was there. They had never actually seen what the Israelites were about to witness. Now if we go over to chapter 8, in chapter 8 of Exodus, we find here in chapter 8 this division that takes place at the time when the really the swarms, it would be a better translation for it. If you notice in verse 20 of Exodus chapter 8, it says, "The Eternal said to Moses, rise up early in the morning, and stand before Pharaoh, and lo, he comes forth to the water. You say to him, thus says the Eternal, let my people go that they may serve me. And else, if you will not let my people go, behold, I will send swarms upon you." Of flies isn't there. If you notice on it's in italics in the King James, it literally is swarms. It doesn't even specify exactly what it is. It could probably be swarms of many different types of insects. But we'll come on to that as we come into it. And swarms upon you and upon your servants and upon your people and into your houses and the houses of the Egyptians should be full of swarms and all the ground on which they are. And I will sever in that day in the land of Goshen, in which my people dwell, that no swarms shall be there, to the end that you may know that I am the Eternal in the midst of the earth. And I'll put a division between my people, your people. Tomorrow shall this sign be. So from this point, now here we're looking at the fourth plague that was coming on them. From this point, this was the time when these seven last plagues were about to start, and those seven last plagues in Egypt were specifically for the Egyptians. It was not for the Israelites. The Israelites were separated, and in the same way, you look in the seven last plagues and the ones that were the type that came before, you look at the trumpet plagues, and you find that the people of God were separated just before those trumpet plagues occurred. But the heavenly signs and the various things that led up to that time, they were involved. They were involved with that. There are also people who are part of the church that actually go through the tribulation, for example. But when you come to the trumpet plagues, which were a type of the seven last plagues to come later, you find this separation of the 144,000 taking place. Now, if you turn over to Exodus chapter 12, you find here where it's talking about the firstborn dying, and here in verse 12 of Exodus chapter 12, it says, "For I will pass through the land of Egypt this night, and I'll smite all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, man and beast, and against all the gods of Egypt, I will execute judgment. I am the Eternal." Yes, you can translate that as mighty ones. It's Elohim. And there's no problem with that. But as you find out, there's a little bit more to it. Turn over to Numbers 33. Numbers 33. And we'll find here in Numbers 33 the same kind of sentiment actually mentioned in verse 4. It says, Moses wrote their goings out according to their journeys. Verse 4. "For the Egyptians buried all their firstborn, which the Eternal had smitten among them, and upon their gods also the Eternal executed judgments." And when you go through the plagues of Egypt, this is Numbers 33, verse 4, when you go through the plagues of Egypt, you can see how God actually takes out the very gods themselves and deals with. Because the Egyptians, if you notice the Egyptian hieroglyphics, and you see all these hieroglyphics, and you, I know that when we went to, what's the name of that house? In Derbyshire, Chatsworth House, yes, we went round there, there's some hieroglyphics there, but you'll find they're various gods. You get this god with his kind of wolf head and a human body and all these various gods that you find. And even so, as you go in, you actually find the mummies. You don't just find human mummies of pharaohs. You find animal mummies as well within Egypt, the Egyptologists have. So they worshipped all kinds of different gods. There were a great, huge pantheon of them. So if we go through the actual plagues themselves, we turn again back to Exodus chapter 7, and just start to look and examine at some of these plagues. We'll start with the first one, obviously, which is the plague of blood. The water is actually changing to blood. And here we find, it says in verse 14, "And the Eternal said to Moses, Pharaoh's heart is hardened. He refuses to let the people go. Go to Pharaoh in the morning, and lo, he goes out to the water, and you will stand at the river's brink, against where he comes. And the rod which you turn to a serpent, you'll take in your hand. And you will say to him, the Eternal God of the Hebrews." It's interesting, it uses the word Hebrews, the sons of Eber. It goes long, long back. I mean, basically, when you're looking at Israel, it's not just the Israelites. You're looking at the promises to Abraham and to, I think it was his great-grandfather, which was Eber. So you're looking right back to a much bigger generation that the people of the Egyptians were actually against. And he says, "And you shall say unto him, the Eternal God of the Hebrews has sent me unto you, saying, Let my people go, that they may serve me in the wilderness. And behold, here too you would not hear. Thus says the Eternal, in this you shall know that I am Yahweh. I am the Eternal." And here is the beginning of this sentiment that was expressed over in chapter 6, where it says, they knew me as Al Shaddai in the past, but here they're going to understand that this is Yahweh. And as we'll come on and look at the plagues in the future, the name, and us within the church, recognizing the name of God, which is Yahweh Sabaoth, the Yahweh of armies. And when we are facing the problems that we will undoubtedly face, we need to get our minds back onto some of these things and realize just how this individual who became Christ in the future, how he actually dealt with the people that opposed themselves against the people of God. And it says, "Thus says the Eternal, in this you shall know that I am Yahweh, I am the Eternal. Behold, I will smite with a rod that which is in my hand on the waters, which is the river. They'll be turned to blood. The fish that will be in the river will die. The river will stink. The Egyptians shall loathe to drink the water of the river. And the Eternal spoke to Moses, say to Aaron, take your rod," and he got him to smite it. "And he said, even in the vessels of wood and the vessels of stone." So he did this in verse 20, and it's in the sight of Pharaoh and in the sight of the servants, and all the waters that were in the river were turned to blood. And the fish, in verse 21, "And the fish that was in the river died, the river stank, the Egyptians couldn't drink the water of the river, there was blood throughout all the land of Egypt. And the magicians of Egypt did so with their enchantments." You think, well, haven't they got enough? You say, well, where do they get the water from? Well, if you just read on a little bit, it says in verse 24, and all the Egyptians dug around the river for water to drink, for they couldn't drink of the water of the river. So they were able to get fresh water around it by digging in the surrounding area and filtering out whatever was this cause of this reddening and this blood-like, or this blood, which is what they're calling, I think it is a reddening of the water of something which was presumably poisonous of some description. And they would take some of that fresh water and then they would change it into blood themselves. But again, the mind of man is insane, absolutely insane. It says 7 days were fulfilled, notice in verse 25, and after the Eternal had smitten the river. So for 7 days they had no water, apart from what they specifically filtered by the side. Now the interesting thing is, when you look at the actual gods of Egypt, the Nile was sacred. They actually believed that it was the bloodstream of Osiris, of the god of the underworld. And this bloodstream, so God said to himself, okay, fine, you want it as a bloodstream of Osiris, I'll give you bloodstream. And here the blood started pouring down the water. There's also, where were the various gods? And not only Osiris, I mean, his bloodstream was being polluted, but also, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, but Khnum, I think it is probably pronounced, who's the guardian of the Nile. This particular god was not available. Happy, the spirit of the Nile, who Happy is partnered with all these other gods, and you even have the concept of happy birthday and this kind of thing. It is coming from this kind of concept. Toret, which is a hippopotamus goddess. Where was she when the thing went into blood? And Nu, which was the god of life in the Nile. All the fish. Of course, the fish died. So, okay, where's this god that's supposed to be protecting this wonderful life that's in the Nile? You know, Christ was moving in there, and he was just in one stroke severing all these gods within Egypt. Now, if we come on to the second one in Exodus chapter 8, you find here the God, in verse 1, the Eternal spoke to Moses, go to Pharaoh and say to him, thus says the Eternal, let my people go that may serve me, and if you don't, then I will smite all your borders with frogs, and the river will bring forth frogs abundantly, which will go up and come into your house, your bedchambers. And here's Polysyndeton, notice what he says, and the river shall bring forth frogs abundantly, which shall go up and come into your house, and into your bedchambers, and upon your bed, and in the house of your servants, and upon the people, and into your ovens, and into your kneading troughs, and the frogs shall come up both in you, and upon your people, and upon all your servants. It's what all the way through, even in the actual writing of it. It's a case of every single time you look at this, it's going to be a problem. Every single place you turn, you're going to have frogs until you're absolutely, totally sick of them. And as I say, these first three, it also happened to the Israelites as well. At least it wasn't cockroaches. And the Eternal spoke to Moses, said to Aaron, stretch forth your hand over the rod of the streams of the rivers and over the ponds. And Aaron stretched his hand over the waters of Egypt, and the frogs came up, and they covered the lands of Egypt. And verse 7, the magicians did with their enchantments and brought the frogs on the land of Egypt. So they added to the problem, but whatever. Again, great wisdom and everything else. Well, not exactly. But you know, with the frog. The frog itself was looked upon as a god, and it was looked upon as actually a theophany. In other words, it was something which was an expression of the god or goddess. It's a theophany of the goddess Hekt, H-E-Q-T or H-E-T. And this goddess was actually the goddess of birth, and she was supposed to be the wife of the creator of the world. And the women who actually gave birth in Egypt would wear these amulets and various bits on their body with frogs on them, in order to, when they gave birth, to try and invoke the spirit of this goddess Hekt. In fact, certain people, if you accidentally kill the frog, you risk the death penalty. They were so sacred. So what were they doing? They were shoveling these things in great heaps and rotting, decaying heaps of frogs. And again, it was just poking another fun at the very God of Egypt. And we're looking here at this polysyndeton here. We see that it just hits over and over and over again. In every single area of your life, you will get your frogs until they're coming out your ears. Everywhere you look, you're going to have frogs. If we come on to the third one, notice in verse 16, it says, "And the Eternal said to Moses, say to Aaron, stretch out your rod and smite the dust of the land, that it may become lice throughout all the land of Egypt. And they did so, for Aaron stretched out his hand with his rod, and he smote the dust of the earth, and it became lice in man and beast, and all the dust of the land became lice throughout all the land of Egypt. And the magicians did so with their enchantments to bring forth life, but they couldn't. And so there were lice upon man and upon beast." Now this was again, Israel was affected. So it was pretty uncomfortable for Israel. It was pretty uncomfortable at that time. There were still lice there. And there's various ways of translating this word lice. Some people reckon there are mosquitoes. But quite frankly, you're looking at the word that is used. It comes from a root word that probably means to dig. In other words, whatever it was buried underneath the skin, and you had to dig the thing out. So it was pretty nasty, a pretty nasty thing to have. But it was particularly nasty for one group of people. And that group of people, Herodotus, in the account of Egypt, he says the following. He says, "The priests shave themselves all over their body every other day, so that no lice or any other foul thing may come to be upon them when they minister to the gods. And the priests wear garments of linen only, and sandals of papyrus, and any other garment they may not take, nor other sandals. These wash themselves in cold water twice a day, and twice again in the night." So and they actually shaved off all hair. They shaved everything, you know, eyebrows, everything, off their entire body to make sure that there no lice whatsoever could be on them. So they were to be able to function as a priest. Then there was a real problem if they had lice on them. These lice were everywhere, and they were burrowing into their skin. And again, here is Christ poking fun at the very priests, the priests that were performing all these miracles and things as well to try and counter, and they couldn't do this particular thing. We find the names of Jannes and Jambres mentioned over in Timothy, in 2 Timothy 3:8. You don't need to turn there, but from the Jewish Encyclopedia, it says the Jannes and Jambres were the names of two legendary wizards of Pharaoh who withstood Moses by imitating with their enchantments the works of Moses and Aaron, though they were defeated. According to rabbinical tradition, they were the two chiefs of the magicians at the court of Pharaoh, who foretold the birth of Moses, who was, quote, the destroyer of the land of Egypt, unquote, thereby causing the cruel edicts of the Pharaoh. So the demons could see that this was coming, and they went ahead and allowed their servants to have a prophecy to see that this was actually coming on the land of Egypt with all the plagues and everything else. But you see, Christ, in dealing with the magicians, and Jannes and Jambres were undoubtedly some of them, he allowed the lice to get in there, and all their cleanliness and everything else was totally wasted. It was totally negated by this action. We go on to the next one, which are these swarms that I mentioned. And now we see, as I've brought out before, how Israel is protected. But here in Exodus 8, where it talks about these swarms, as I say, if you notice, of flies, the word of flies is not there. Now, you say, well, what were these swarms? Well, notice what it actually says in verse 21. It says, if you won't let my people go, but look, I will send swarms upon you, and upon your servants, and your people, and into your houses, and the houses of the Egyptians shall be full of swarms, and also the ground on which they are. So in other words, it wasn't just swarms in the air, it was swarms on the ground as well. Everything was being covered by these swarms of insects of some description. Now, there's one particular insect that literally can go ahead and bite through wood. It's got enough of a bite on this thing, and it's the scarab beetle. Now the scarab beetle pushes dung. It's the thing that goes around gathering all the dung and pushing dung into it, you're burying it. Now if I don't know whether it would be sufficient with the frogs and everything else that would bring the scarab beetles to the fore or not, I doubt if that was the case. But whatever these swarms were, it is interesting that when you're looking at the god, and that is Amun-Ra, in other words, Ra was the sun god, but he was supposed to have the head of a scarab beetle. And the reason why he had the head of a scarab beetle was that just like the scarab beetle pushes the dung around and rolls this nice circular ball of dung around the desert and buries it and all the rest of it, Ra, or Amun-Ra, because there were two gods and apparently they joined them later at some juncture, Amun-Ra would push the sun around its course. And so he had the head of a scarab beetle pushing this sun round its course. And again, these things, even the flies, if there were flies involved, and probably there were, I mean, it wasn't just the scarab beetle, there were swarms of all different kinds. And if the flies were there, Beelzebub also, the lord of the flies, would be within this remit as well. And it says in verse 24, "And the Eternal did so, and there came a grievous swarm into the house of Pharaoh, and upon his servants' houses, and in all the land of Egypt. And the land was corrupted by reason of the swarm. And Pharaoh called Moses and Aaron and said, Go sacrifice to your God in the land. And Moses said, It's not fitting to do so, for we shall sacrifice the abomination of the Egyptians to the Eternal our God. Lo, we will sacrifice the abomination of the Egyptians before their eyes, and will they not stone us? We will go 3 days' journey into the wilderness and sacrifice. And Pharaoh said, I'll let you go that you may sacrifice the Eternal your God in the wilderness, only you will not go very far away, entreat for me. And then he lifted the swarms, and he hardened his heart, and he's back to square one again. As God says, and as Christ actually said. And then we come on to the next one, the fifth of the plagues, and we find the livestock being affected. And this you'll find in chapter 9. It says, The Eternal said to Moses, Go into Pharaoh, tell him, Thus says the Eternal, God of the Hebrews, Let my people go, they may see it serve me. And if you don't do it, then the hand of the Eternal is upon your cattle, which is in the field, upon the horses and the asses, the camels, the oxen, and on the sheep. There'll be a very grievous murrain. Now, it doesn't actually say what this was, but the suggestion that people have had is it's a form of anthrax. And this actually, you know, it would kill them, you know, pronto. And the Eternal shall sever between the cattle of Israel and the cattle of Egypt. And then nothing die of all that's the children of Israel. So the distinction again, there's your line. And from this, here are the seven last plagues of Egypt. And these seven last plagues, there was a distinction. The distinction was between Israel and the Egyptians. Up to that time of the seven, the Israelites had to suffer. And the Eternal appointed a set time, saying, Tomorrow the Eternal will do this thing in the land, and the Eternal did that thing in the morrow. And all the cattle of Egypt died, but the cattle of the children of Israel died not one. And Pharaoh sent, and behold, there was not one of the cattle of the Israelites dead. And the heart of Pharaoh was hardened, and he didn't let the people go. Now, again, when you're looking at this, these gods, the god that you've probably seen various pictures of is this Apis bull. The Apis bull, you see the horns of the bull, and you have this disc, like a sun disc, in the centre of the horns. You go down to the British Museum, you've got them all down there. You can see the actual bulls down there, the Apis bull. This was a living image, apparently, according to them, of the god Ptah, or another name for Osiris. It says, the Apis bull, this is actually coming from toursofegypt.net. It says, the Apis bull was originally considered to be the incarnation of the god Ptah, the creator of the universe and master of destiny. But this was a lesser-known association. Later, the Apis became widely known as the incarnation of Osiris, the god of embalming and cemeteries. When Ptah himself took on funeral characteristics and became associated with Osiris, these gods kept on kind of merging and kind of in some kind of political unions, I think. Plutarch wrote that the Apis was a fair and beautiful image of the soul of Osiris. At any rate, only one bull was considered to be the sacred Apis at a time, and a replacement could be sought only upon the death of the bull. And the new Apis was transported to Memphis on a boat with a specially built golden cabin. And this bull was actually, as soon as the old Apis bull died, they'd go ahead and the priests would go out and they'd search around the countryside looking for a certain calf with distinct markings. And also on its tongue it had certain markings that they were looking for. And they'd find this calf, and they'd go ahead and put it in this kind of golden boat and sail it down to the various temple. And it would live there in the height of splendor with its own little harem of cows. And it says, the birth of an Apis calf was a time of celebration among ancient Egyptians, since this meant that a living god had been born into their midst. So this Apis calf, that is then living in this splendor with all its kind of wives and harem and all the rest of it. It says, when an Apis bull died, the body was embalmed and entombed with great ceremony that would be afforded royalty. A Memphis temple housing large alabaster slabs was in place in which the bulls were embalmed. And after preparation of the body and internal organs, the crouching bull was intricately bandaged, artificial eyes were inserted, its horns and face were either gilded or covered with gold leaf mask, and it was covered with a shroud. The Apis mummy was carried to the Serapeum, a catacomb preserved by the Avenue of Sphinxes, amid the formalities due a deity, for burial in a massive stone sarcophagus weighing over 60 tons. I mean, the amount of elaborate ritual, all for this Apis bull. And God, Jesus Christ, wiped out all the cattle. And all the cattle included the Apis bull and his mother, who was venerated as well, apparently, and all his harem, the whole lot, gone. So obviously, I mean, they must be able to get them from somebody. I would presume they would then buy them from the Israelites. They'd go to the Israelites and say, well, can we go and buy some bulls and some cows? So they get the restocked. While this was going on, okay, what about Isis Hathor, who was the living image of the cow? Every cow was a living image of the Isis Hathor, the goddess. Every ram was a living image of Khnum. The cats were living images of Bast. All these various gods, and you find these sarcophaguses of these animals that have been embalmed. Again, they were worshipped. They were worshipped within Israel. Some of them were worshipped within Israel, unfortunately, because that's where you get the golden calf. That's where the golden calf comes from. Because it was such a high culture within Egypt. And then you come to number 6, which are the boils. Again, Exodus 9, notice verse 8. And the Eternal said unto Moses, saying to Aaron, take your handfuls of ashes of the furnace, and let Moses sprinkle it towards the heaven in the sight of Pharaoh. And it shall become small dust in all the land of Egypt, and be a boil breaking forth with veins upon the man and beast throughout all the land of Egypt. And it took ashes of the... And the interesting thing is, it's not just any old furnace. It actually says the furnace. It's a definite article being used within the Hebrew. And therefore, the furnace makes you wonder, well, what furnace was there in front of Pharaoh and stood before Pharaoh? They took the ashes of the furnace and stood before Pharaoh, and Moses sprinkled it up towards heaven, and it became a boil breaking forth with blains upon man and beast. Now, when we're looking at Bullinger, he says that the definite article implies that some particular furnace is meant. And it says that Pharaoh is near it. Thus it says to you, there's no mere heating apparatus. It says, the Companion Bible says that this furnace, i.e. the one of the altars on which human sacrifices were sometimes offered to propitiate their god Typhon, the evil principle. These were doubtless being offered to avert the plagues. And Moses, using the ashes in the same way as they used the ashes of the victims, throw them up, and where the ashes actually fell, it gave them a blessing. He threw them up in the air, and wherever the ashes fell, and across the entire land of Egypt, there were boils. And so again, you're looking at this this particular individual, which is their god Typhon, the very specific god that is being rubbished by this particular action. In addition, you've also got many other gods that are being rubbished at the same time. You've got Serapis, which was the god of healing. You've got Imhotep, which is the god of medicine. And the Egyptians were well into medicine, and to a large degree. And Thoth, which is the god of learning. Again, you see these kind of this god with kind of like a long ibis snout, again on the head of a man. You see them in the hieroglyphics. That's the Thoth, and it's the god of learning. And where was he? Where were all these gods and goddesses that they've been worshipping and doing all these ablations to? When this lot comes along, I mean, it just wipes them out. And again, he's rubbishing all the gods of Egypt. In Exodus 9, verse 13, the Eternal said to Moses, "Rise up early in the morning and stand before Pharaoh and say to him, 'Thus says the Eternal God of the Hebrews, let my people go that they may serve me. For I will at this time send all my plagues upon your heart and your servants and your people, that you may know that there's none like me in all the earth. And now I will stretch out my hand, I may smite you and your people with pestilence, and you'll be cut off from the earth.'" And he goes on about him being exalted. And it says, verse 18, "Behold, tomorrow, about this time, I will cause it to rain, a very grievous hail, such as has never been seen in Egypt since the foundation thereof, even till now. And send therefore now, and gather your cattle." So they obviously have gone out and they've bought some cattle, presumably from the Israelites, and they've got them out in the field again. They said, "Okay, you go out and get your cattle and bring them all back in again. If you don't, they'll die." And those that feared the word of the Eternal did so, and they survived. And the Eternal, verse 22, said to Moses, "Stretch forth your hand towards heaven. There may be hail in all the land of Egypt, upon man and beast, and every herb of the field, every vegetable that is, throughout the land of Egypt." And Moses stretched forth his rod towards heaven, and the Eternal sent thunder and hail, and the fire ran along the ground. And the Eternal rained hail upon the land of Egypt. And there was hail, and fire mingled with the hail, very grievous, such as there was nothing like it in all the land of Egypt since it became a nation. Now, whether this was actually meteorites, or whether this was a mere incredible storm such as we have never, ever seen, it's not clear. But certainly, this was something that they'd never, ever seen before. Notice verse 26, "Only in the land of Goshen, where the children of Israel were, there was no hail." So there's a distinction again between the two. "But the hail smoke," in verse 25, "throughout all the land of Egypt, all that was in the field, man and beast, and the hail smote every vegetable in the field, and broke every tree in the field." So the trees were being broken. It was literally breaking the tiles, presumably on the roofs. And it was certainly something which, when they started to pray to their gods, who were they looking to? Well, they were looking to Nut. Nut was the goddess of the sky. Where was Nut when all this was going on? I mean, was she nuts? I mean, why on earth doesn't she do something, they were thinking to themselves. Or Shu, the god of the wind. Horus, the god of the sky of Upper Egypt. And also there was a god and goddess for protecting crops of Isis and Set. Again, these gods and goddesses were all... they just weren't there. They didn't exist. Or the demons were not able to go ahead and act at this time. They had no force whatever. And Janus and Jambres, the main magicians, had nothing there. There was nothing there for them to be able to access. When you come to Exodus 10, if there's much left of the hail, that little bit that was left, so the hail broke all the branches down, and then once that had happened, then it flattened everything, it killed any man or beast that was out in the field. But here in Exodus 10, the Eternal said to Moses, "Go to Pharaoh, I've hardened his heart, the heart of his servants, and I will show these my signs before him." And each time it starts to expand more and more about what was actually coming. And in verse 4, it says, "Else if you refuse, let my people go, tomorrow I'll bring the locusts to your coast, and they will cover the face of the earth, that one cannot be able to see the earth. and they shall eat the residue of that which is escaped, which remains to you from the hail, and shall eat every tree which grows of you out of the field. And they will fill your houses, and your houses of your servants, the houses of all the Egyptians, which neither your fathers nor the fathers' fathers have ever seen since the day they were on the earth. And in verse 12, the Eternal said to Moses, stretch out your hand over the land of Egypt, for the locusts, that they may come on the land of Egypt, eat every herb of the land, even all the hail that all the hail has left. And Moses stretched forth his rod over the land of Egypt, and the Eternal brought an east wind upon the land of all that day, all that night, and when it was morning, the wind brought the locusts. And the locusts went up over all the land of Egypt, and rested on the coasts of Egypt. Very grievous were they. Before them there was no such locust as they, neither after them shall there be such. For they covered the face of the whole earth, so that the land was darkened, and they ate every herb of the land, and all the fruit of the trees which the hail had left. And there remained not any green thing in the trees, nor in the herbs of the field throughout the entire land of Egypt. So we're looking here, that everything that was left, that the hail hadn't actually damaged, was completely, all the green, just gone. Totally and utterly gone. And during this time, again, they would pray to their gods. And the gods they were looking for were Nepri, the goddess, or the god of grain. Isis and Set, the protection of crops. Thermuthis, which is the goddess of fertility. All these various gods and goddesses that they had, which could not do anything against the locusts. So you come then to Exodus chapter 10, and finally you get 3 days of darkness. And Exodus chapter 10, and here in verse 21, and the Eternal said to Moses, stretch out your hand towards heaven, that there may be darkness over the land of Egypt, even darkness which may be felt. So not, this wasn't just an ordinary darkness. This was a darkness, there was something in the air that they literally could feel. There was something which had filled the air to such a degree that they could feel this, whatever it was. And Moses stretched forth his hand towards heaven, and there was a thick darkness in the land of Egypt 3 days. So for 3 days this plague was on there. And they didn't even see one another, neither did any rise from his place for 3 days. But all the children of Israel had light in their dwellings. So the distinction between the two was huge. They were able to actually have the light in the dwellings. The atmosphere was not thick in the land of Goshen, but in the land where the Egyptians were, the atmosphere itself hung, and it was thick. And for 3 days, this was the actual case. And Pharaoh called to Moses and said, go, you serve the Eternal, only let your flocks and herds be stayed, let your little ones go with you. And again, during this time, what were the gods? Well, the god of Egypt was Amun-Re. He was the sun god. This one with his scarab head beetle that used to push the sun across the sky. This one was the god that was worshipped, the main god. When you think of Egypt, even this Apis bull had the circle of the sun god in its horns. And this thing was revered to a huge degree. So Amun-Re was really just blotted out, removed. And to the Egyptians, every single god that they had was being wiped out. This particular one was particularly supposed to be the most powerful of the lot. Horus, the god of light, he was wiped out. Ptah, who created the earth, the moon, and the sun, well, where was he at this time? Atum, who created the sun, what happened to him? Tem, the god of sunset. Shu, the god of sunlight and the air. So again, you're looking at all these various gods and goddesses that in those days of darkness were not there. And then you finally come in Exodus 11, notice in verse 4. And Moses says, thus says the Eternal, about midnight I will go into the midst of Egypt, and all the firstborn in the land of Egypt will die. From the firstborn of Pharaoh that sits on his throne, even to the firstborn of the maidservant that's behind the mill, and all the firstborn of the beasts. And there will be a great cry throughout all the land of Egypt, such as there's not been like it, and never, nor shall it be like it any more. But against any of the children of Israel shall not even a dog move his tongue, against man or beast, that you may know how the Eternal puts a difference between Egyptians and Israel. And this distinction in this final one, was huge, obviously, because they were passing underneath the blood in the Passover. And here in Exodus chapter 12 and in verse 29, it says, "And it came to pass that at midnight," Exodus 12:29, "the Eternal smote all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh that sat on the throne, to the firstborn of the captive that was in the dungeon, and the firstborn of all cattle. And Pharaoh rose up in the night, he and his servants, and all the Egyptians, and there was a great cry in Egypt. There was not a house where there wasn't one dead. And he called for Moses and Aaron by night, and said, 'Look, get out.'" And that was the final tenth plague, or the seventh of seven last plagues. You can look at it both ways round. The seventh plague, where it was specifically against the Egyptians, and Israel was protected. And in this plague, you know, there are so many gods and goddesses that should have been protecting the people according to their ideas. Meskhenet, the goddess of the birth of the children. Hathor, the attendant of the birth, is one of seven attenders that attend the birth of children. Min, the god of procreation. Isis, the goddess of fertility. Selket, the guardian of life. Renenutut, the guardian of Pharaoh. All of these so-called gods and goddesses were absent. Their power, you know, there was no power. And yet, Jannes and Jambres, you know, they were in contact with demons. They were able to do miracles. They were able to do these things. And these things were real. They weren't just kind of arbitrary. Yes, they used trickery as well, undoubtedly. But they were in contact with the demon spirit world. But the demon spirit world can do nothing when God steps in. Nothing whatsoever can be done by the demon spirit world. And so when we come to the last plagues, let's turn over to Malachi chapter 3 first of all, because we've seen how it says that by the name El Shaddai, Abraham, Isaac and Jacob knew me, the great blesser, but my name, the Eternal, Yahweh, I wasn't known, because they hadn't actually seen him acting, this one that became Christ, here in the end of Malachi 3. They'd never seen him actually acting in the way that he was about to act within Egypt. And here in Malachi 3 verse 16, it says, "Those that feared the Eternal, Yahweh," this name that was said to Moses, that they haven't seen this in me acting in this way, "spoke often one to another, and the Eternal listened and heard it, and a book of remembrance was written before him of those that feared the Eternal and that thought on his name." Whose name? The Eternal's name. "And they shall be mine," says the Eternal Yahweh Sabaoth, the Eternal of hosts. It's the Eternal of armies, in the day that I make up my jewels. So the protection will be there on God's people. And then when we come over to Revelation 6, we turn over to Revelation 6, we see here, when we're looking at these parallels between the trumpet plagues and the seven last plagues, here in Revelation chapter 6, we see all the various seals being opened. And it goes right the way down to the heavenly signs in verse 12. "And there was a great earthquake, the sun became black as sackcloth as hair, the moon became as blood, and the stars of heaven fell to the earth even as a fig tree." All of these things, God's people are around, they're witnessing them, they're in amongst it all at that time. And there are certain scary stuff that really we will witness. But it then comes into chapter 7. And in chapter 7 we see that there's a distinction then placed. In chapter 7 verse 1 it says, "After these things I saw four angels." Now notice, four angels, okay? Make a note of that. "Four angels standing into the four corners of the earth, holding the four winds of the earth, that the wind shouldn't blow on the earth, nor on the sea or any tree. And I saw another angel ascending from the east, having the seal of the living God. And he cried with a loud voice to the four angels to whom it was given to hurt the earth, the sea, saying, 'Don't hurt the earth and neither the sea nor trees until we've sealed the servants of our living God in their foreheads.'" So these four were going to actually blow the trumpets, the first four trumpets, because you've got four trumpets and then you've got three woes, and the woes are interesting, and we go on, we'll have a look at these woes again. When you're looking at the seven last plagues and you're looking at the seven trumpets, there is a parallel between the two, as we'll come on and see. And certainly when you're looking at what happened in Egypt and how these seven last plagues of Egypt were the seven last plagues where Israel was protected, and the first three were where they weren't, there is also a parallel between where you see here the 144,000 being protected before coming into the seven trumpet plagues, which are a type of the seven last plagues which God, well, Christ, actually unleashes on the earth. When you look here, you find these four winds mentioned, the 144,000 sealed. And if you want to go ahead and put a marker in, you certainly be worth putting a marker in chapter 8 and chapter 16, because we'll go back and forth between 8 and 16. And just notice, oh, you can do it if you've got two hands like I have, you can go ahead and probably get, but if you've got two hands and you're trying to write notes as well, you might find it a bit difficult. Or somebody can go ahead and turn to one and somebody turn to another, however you want to do it. But chapter 8 and chapter 16, I want you to notice. The first one, you think, well, there's no parallel at all. Chapter 8, verse 7. What am I doing here? Yeah, chapter 8, verse 7. It says, "The first angel sounded, and there followed hail and fire mingled with blood, and they were cast upon the earth, and the third part of the trees was burnt up, and all green grass was burnt up." And over in 16, verse 2, you find, "The first went out and poured out his vial upon the earth, and there fell a noisome and grievous sore upon the men that had the mark of the beast and upon those that worshipped his image." Now, there's no parallel apparent within those two. But you wonder whether when we actually go on and read the others and we'll actually see the parallels between them, whether in fact there is a parallel between those two, but they just simply aren't mentioned. Whether in fact we can say, well, this hail and fire mingles with blood will produce a sore. And perhaps there'll be a hail and fire mingled with blood, which will produce the sore that will be there in that first one. But let's just have a look at some of the other ones. Chapter 8, verse 8. "And the second angel sounded, and as it were, a great mountain burning with fire cast into the sea." Notice where it went. It went into the sea. "And the third part of the sea became blood. A third part of the creatures that were in the sea had life died. And a third part of the ships were destroyed." So a third part. This is prior to Christ's return now. A third part of the sea. Now, whether that means the Mediterranean or whether that means all oceans, it doesn't say. But a third part has been destroyed. When you come over to 16, verse 3, it says, "The second angel poured out his vial upon the sea, and it became as the blood of a dead man, and every living creature died in the sea." So it almost appears that there's a plague in the trumpet plague, and then it is finished off in the seven last plagues. And it's almost as if they maybe get over it. They maybe do their bits and pieces to try and overcome the initial trumpet plague. But when you come to Christ actually using the plagues to war, the seven last plagues, he uses and finishes the job. Notice you come on to the third one, 8 verse 10. "And the third angel sounded, and there fell a great star from heaven, burning as it were a lamp. It fell to the third part of the rivers, and upon the fountains of waters. And the name of the star is called Wormwood, and then the third part of the waters became Wormwood. And many men died of the waters, because they were made bitter." And if you go then across to chapter 16, verse 4, "The third angel poured out his vial upon the rivers, and the fountains of water, and they became blood. And I heard the angel of the water say, 'You are righteous, O Lord, that are and was, because you rejudged,'" and so on. "And you shed the blood of saints and prophets, and you have given them blood to drink, for they are worthy." And so it appears that they all became blood. And again, you've got this contrast between the two. One, a third happens. The other, it finishes the job. You come over to chapter 8, verse 12, and it says, "The fourth angel sounded, and the third part of the sun was smitten, and the third part of the moon, and the third part of the stars, so the third part of them was darkened, and the day shone not for a third part of it, the night likewise." So that's hit the sun, the moon, and the stars, and it actually reduces the heat of the sun, moon, and the stars. And then when you come over to chapter 16, verse 8, you find the fourth angel poured out his vial upon the sun, and the power was given to him to scorch men with fire, and men were scorched with great heat and blasphemed the name of God. So again, you put up with the fact that it was made less, but then you come into the seven last plagues, and it actually is used to scorch men. Again, there's a parallel between the two. When you come then into the woes, now those that remember the first four angels, were given They held the four angels back, the wind of the four angels, that blew the first of the four of the seven trumpets. But then you come on to woes, and each of these woes, you'll find, is to do with something which is a potentiality that's about to occur. And the potentiality, notice what it's all about. Here in chapter 9, verse 1, it says, "The fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star fall from heaven to the earth, and to him was given the key to the bottomless pit. And he opened the abyss, and there arose smoke out of the pit, as a smoke of a great furnace, and the sun and the air were darkened by the reason of the smoke of the pit." So here is darkness that is being done by the beast power. The beast power darkens the air. And in addition, what are they making? Verse 6. "In those days shall men seek death, and they'll not find it. They'll desire to die, and death will flee from them." And it is to do with the weaponry that the beast power is making and manufacturing. That's the woe. But then what does God do? What does Christ do when he returns? If you go over to chapter 16, verse 10, "And the fifth angel poured out his vial upon the seat of the beast," which is where this problem is coming from, "and his kingdom was full of darkness, and they gnawed their tongues for pain." So in other words, he rewards the beast kingdom with exactly what the beast kingdom was trying to devise in the woe leading to the end of the world, of the age. And here in chapter 8, chapter 9, chapter 9, verse 6. I've got that one. Chapter 9, let's have a look. Chapter 9, verse 16. Chapter 9, verse 16. It says, "And the number of the armies of the horsemen were 200,000,000, and I heard the number of them, and I saw the horsemen of the vision." Let's pick it up in verse 13. "And the sixth angel sounded, and I heard a voice from the four horns of the golden altar which is before God, saying to the sixth angel which had the trumpet, 'Loose the four angels which are bound in the great river Euphrates.' And the angels are loosed which were prepared for an hour and a day and a month and a year to slay the third part of men." Now, he loosed the angels, but it doesn't say that they actually slayed them. They were slain there. But there was a whole host of I personally feel they're computerized, they're not tanks, they're something almost computerized, walking spider-like things. So the army of Joel. And you're looking here at this army coming in from the east, and yet, it is a potential threat that was there. When you come to chapter 16, notice in verse 12, "And the sixth angel poured out his vial to the great river Euphrates, the water thereof was dried up, that the way of the kings of the east may be prepared." So one has sent the demons out to stir it up. The problem is then coming towards the beast power. And the other woe that we've got is the beast power arming and ready to fight against the other. And then you come here in chapter 12 and you see the fulfillment of it. And how the time of the east, and the east is prepared, and the three spirits, like unclean spirits like frogs, come out of the mouth of the dragon and the beast and the mouth of the false prophet. They're spirits of devils working miracles, which go into the kings of the earth and the whole world to gather them together to the battle of the great day of God Almighty. And he says, "Behold, I come as a thief. Blessed is he that watches and keeps his garments." And he gathered them together into a place in the Hebrew tongue called Armageddon. That's the Vale of Megiddo in the north near Galilee. And the seven, that's the gathering of the people from the east come across. They start coming across in the trumpet blast on the sixth trumpet. And it's then finally completed. They gathered to this place of Armageddon. And then when you look at the seventh trumpet, verse 15 of chapter 11, that's the return of Christ, in which the last plagues are all part of that return. And the seventh plague, as you notice in verse 17 of chapter 16, "The seventh angel poured his vial upon the air, and there came a great voice out of the temple saying, of heaven and of the throne, saying, 'It's done.' And there was voices and thunders and lightning and a great earthquake, such as never been since there was upon the earth, so mighty an earthquake and so great. The great city was divided into three parts. The cities of the nations fell. The great Babylon came into remembrance before God to give to her the cup of her wine of the fierceness of his wrath. Every island fled away. The mountains weren't found. There fell upon a great hail from heaven, every stone the weight of a talent, and men blasphemed God because of the plague of the hail, for the plague was exceeding great. And that, again, corresponds with the return of Christ and the fighting of Christ with this army of both the beast and also the coming in from the east, both together in Armageddon, that fight against Christ. So here we see this parallel between the trumpet plagues, the seven trumpet plagues, and the seven last plagues, and the seven last plagues in Egypt. Now, they're not the same plagues by any stretch, but you can see the parallels between the two, and you can also see how Israel was protected, and how God's people are going to be protected in the future. So if we find the scripture, turn over to 1 Corinthians chapter 1. 1 Corinthians chapter 1. You see, we have a part in this, because why does God do this? Why does he bring plagues on people? There is a reason. I mean, we've seen all the gods of Egypt, all these things that they put their confidence in, and how he demolished systematically one group of gods after the other. We see the same as far as the future is concerned, that it's not an arbitrary thing. It's an organized thing that he allows certain trumpet plagues to occur, and then he brings in the seven last plagues that mirror those trumpet plagues. They're like a type and anti-type, and that will actually go ahead and complete the job, and undoubtedly destroying all the gods of our world at that time. And the gods of our world at that time are going to have this religious element mixed in with them, as well as the carnal element that we've got in the world today. But here we find ourselves, and look at us. What are we? Nothing. Look at the little group here. There's almost nothing. I'm speaking to a microphone. It goes out through a computer. It's spread across the internet. But where are we? What are we? We're absolutely nothing. And that's the point. That's the point. It's the point of Egypt and the seven last plagues of Egypt and all the plagues of Egypt. The Egyptians, their gods, totally nothing. Totally useless, worthless. The trumpet plagues, again, starts the job. What can mankind do against, you know, things falling out of the sky, meteorites or whatever falling out of the sky? What can mankind do against the eternal that returns in the seven last plagues? And here we find our lesson that we need to learn here in verse 26. For you see your calling, brethren, how not many wise men after the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called, but God has chosen. And they have been specifically selected. We are selected specifically. John 6:44. God has chosen the foolish things of the world to confound the wise. God's chosen the weak things of the world to confound the things that are mighty, and the base things of the world, and the things that are despised, has God chosen, yes, and things that are not, to bring to nothing the things that are. So all of us within the church, there's nothing to us. There is nothing to us. And the reason for all of this, and the reason is that no flesh, what kind of flesh? Egypt's flesh? Pharaoh's flesh? The magician's flesh, Jannes and Jambres' flesh, the beast's flesh, the kings of the earth, you and me. No flesh will glory, it says, in his presence.